We are happy to welcome in our friend, author Colin Fleming. His latest book is If You Brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. Check out his wonderful book on Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. As the holiday season approaches, and look, Scrooge is great anytime, but check out his wonderful book on Scrooge as well. It's Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball?
Congratulations on another week. It is, I believe now, 329 weeks without drinking.
Yeah, a lot of weeks of drinking. I almost wilted. I didn't really almost wilt, but it was a struggle to get through Saturday. It's just difficult days. I spend my weekends alone, so that just mounts, and it's always constant and hard. So didn't return to the bottle, and did a bunch of push-ups, and obviously a lot of work. If anyone reads the blog knows, just work and some stairs.
You have been on fire lately, producing great work, blog entries, keeping us up to date on all that's going on. And today, not that there isn't an area that's in your wheelhouse when it comes to expertise, because you know so many things about so many things, but man, when it comes to jazz, there's nobody out there doing what you do. And we want to talk about a number of jazz topics today. Let's start with a recent piece of yours in Jazz Times about Miles Davis and the 1972 album On the Corner. That is it safe to say not everybody knows how to respond to that album?
It is safe to say that, and it's exactly how it was, more so then when it came out years ago. It's Miles Davis on the verge of checking out as a maker of album statements, which is what he had been doing certainly throughout the 1960s, and once he found himself again in recovery in the late 1950s. But he wasn't a statement maker of albums. They were varied, much like Dylan and the Beatles would vary their albums and concept albums and jazz. And this was going to be really the last of those. He's going to do a truckload of live albums in the 1970s. And that's mostly how he's going to express himself for the first half of the decade, certainly 73, 74, 75. Then we're not going to get a lot of him. So this was an album where he actually didn't play a lot of trumpet. It was meant, I believe, to replicate the noise of a city. And it was met with much resistance upon its release, as if Miles Davis had lost the plot.
And you say that in recent years, too, now people have perhaps swung the other way and rave about it as an underappreciated album, and maybe overlooking some of the flaws that are there.
They go too hard. I don't even know if it's overlooking the flaws so much as people based upon someone's name often want to give them credit for things automatically. I experienced this a lot. I experienced it with the Sam Cooke book you mentioned. There were people who I knew had never listened to Sam Cooke, and had they walked past Sam Cooke singing at the Heinz Convention subway stop, if he didn't live when he lived and live now, and he was this guy doing You Send Me, they wouldn't notice that. But because of the name of Sam Cooke, that was going to be the end-all be-all. I don't think a lot of times people focus on work. Miles Davis, he's that way. If you just heard, I believe, this record, a lot of people wouldn't pay any attention to it. But because of who was behind this record, it became this LP that birthed, oh, so many things, rap and minimalism. Like, it just goes on and on and on. But people weren't sitting around and listening to this album. It didn't do huge numbers in terms of sales, and it's thorny to get into. It's not an album that is in the kind of blue mode. You pop in kind of blue, and you're digging Freddie Freeloader, and you're thinking, I'm Rich Kimball of Bangor. I'm a hip cat. This isn't that way. This is something that you have to spend some time with, and allow yourself to give yourself over to the rhythm. Certain writers are that way. When we read Joyce, some of his trickier works, and we take some time away from Ulysses, it takes us a bit of time to get back into it again when we return. So this was an urban, highly urbanized, it was the most urban Davis ever sounded, version of getting in gear, getting in rhythm, if you will, with those rhythms.
I listened to it last night. It is an album that demands your attention. You can't have it on as background music. And I won't say that I enjoyed the whole thing, but I was impressed with it. And it's, yeah, it does sound like a city. And there were elements, I thought, of early funk in there, some almost a James Brown feel at times.
It's an avant-garde rhythm and blues. And we don't really expect people to cross those two genres, and that's exactly what Davis is doing. And I think the rhythm and blues is especially pronounced. I can see how someone would think it has funk elements. I've always backed away from funk. It's been a limited form of music to me. There isn't any funk artist I like, and when there are people that I do like and they veer towards funk, I balk at that typically. But I hear the rhythm and blues, and I hear whether it's the rhythm and blues of Jimi Hendrix, which he could work in that vein, or Little Willie John, or James Brown early on, certainly pre-funk. James Brown was a rhythm and blues master, but a lot of people don't spend time listening to I Go Crazy, for instance. But I Go Crazy isn't funk, and it's not even really soul. It's that rhythm and blues, and I think the rhythms of On the Corner are in that sort of category, but I could see how someone would think, hey, this isn't really for me. But people think the same thing about, Stravinsky. You listen to Firebird or even The Rite of Spring. That's something that, I don't know, it's not really, I'm going to read a book, what are some tunes I should put on? It's that modernistic and fiercely rhythmic music. So quite a bit of overlap, actually, I think.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Up next, a piece set at smartset.com about Freddie Hubbard entitled Post Bop Bop Man. And you call Hubbard the ultimate musical straddler.
Hubbard was a trumpet player who you'd want to bring in if you wanted to have a killer hard bop session. Now, if people don't know hard bop, it was greasy, rhythm and blues, soulful. It played on jukeboxes. You could have hits with it at the time. If you think of Lee Morgan and Sidewinder, that's hard bop. And it was this in the pocket, just groove oriented, fun music, populist music. You could also bring him in if you had decided you wanted to invent a new style of avant-garde jazz and you needed a trumpet player. So not a lot of people were really that way. And I think Freddie Hubbard, I don't understand really why, beyond sloth and ignorance, he hasn't gotten the recognition that Dizzy Gillespie has, because I think he's the superior artist. Dizzy Gillespie had amazing chops, which is the jazz person's term for technique, the way we talk about a baseball pitcher has amazing stuff. So Gillespie had the chops, and he palled around with Charlie Parker, and he was in on that crucible invention of bebop. But Freddie Hubbard was all over the place at these historical dates, a lot of them happening in 1964, which is what this pretty lengthy piece focuses on. He puts me in mind of the trumpet version of Eric Dolphy. Eric Dolphy spearheaded movements. I don't think John Coltrane becomes a lot of what John Coltrane became if Eric Dolphy wasn't in his ear, giving him encouragement, guidance, vision. I don't think you can overstate the impact on 20th century music of Eric Dolphy. He's one of the half dozen most influential figures, I think, in any combined, if we're just adding everything together. So Freddie Hubbard was the trumpet version of Dolphy.
And listening to some of that music from 64, as an old trumpet player myself, I was impressed with his tone and his ability to change that tone without muting, relying largely on just the embouchure to affect that tone.
He's a fantastic technician, and that's the thing, too. He has the same level of ability, chops-wise, as a Gillespie. I don't know how much better you're going to play on trumpet than Freddie Hubbard. It's like saying, how much better are you going to skate than Bobby Orr, right? Are you going to be in the quote-unquote same ballpark, but it was how Hubbard deployed that technique. I think Gillespie deployed his in a more superficial way. And I'm just using him as an example because he's a trumpet player everyone knows, this virtuoso. And we don't know Freddie Hubbard. How many people who aren't really into jazz know Freddie Hubbard at all? And no one talked him up to me when I was first getting into jazz in my late teens. It was someone I had to hear on my own and think, oh, wow, why aren't we making more of this guy? I just think we get lazy. We fall into these historical comfort spaces where so little is challenged, and we read this thing, and that's more than most people do, and now we're going to repeat that thing. And so you can't do that with Freddie Hubbard. You have to come to Freddie Hubbard, listen to Freddie Hubbard, and you're going to be blown away by Freddie Hubbard.
Up next, a very interesting piece, Alive, I think in 1975, from Cecil Taylor, Nefertiti, the Beautiful One Has Come. And I was reading about it, and someone described it, and I think it was accurate, as pianist as a percussionist.
We're back in 1962 with this, and it's going to be Taylor's main statement for the rest of that decade. Now, the piano is a percussion instrument, but we don't think of it, paradoxically, as a percussion instrument. We think of a percussion instrument as something we take a stick to, and we bang on it, and it makes noise, and we go, yay, this rocks, or this is jazzy, or this swings, or whatever. But that's what the piano is, except instead of a stick, we have our fingers. And Taylor played it, though, as if it were a drum, and it just happened to look like a piano. He beats holy hell out of the thing with this trio. And the sound is rough and tumble. It's not pristine. I think that works to the advantage of the recording. This was one of the first live jazz records that was relatively free. What I mean by that is it's not oriented around a strict meter. It's not the Beatles, for instance. They didn't play free rock and roll. It's always, not always, but it was often 4/4 time and accenting the offbeats. We don't really know where the beat or the pulse might be coming from. And I think this was a breakthrough for this band, this three-piece that Taylor had. It was supposed to be a quartet, but the bassist couldn't make it. And that was fine. And so this was the moment where they realized that they could play in this burgeoning style, which is what free jazz still was in 1962. Ornette Coleman had done his thing. There weren't a lot of free jazz pianists, though. So that was really where Taylor was going to spearhead things.
Another jazz piano great, Bud Powell, and his album, The Amazing Bud Powell. Miles Davis called him the best of the bebop piano players.
Bud Powell, I'm hesitant to almost call him a bebop pianist. I know what Davis meant by that, because that was the idiom he came up through. That was the concurrency of his life. That was what was going on at the time. And he was playing with a lot of Charlie Parker, for instance, who we think of as the quintessential bebop artist. Bud Powell is somebody, and there were these collections of recordings, these LPs, on Blue Note that were an attempt to investigate his genius. Bud Powell is someone, again, who's also not talked about the way the core, the inner group, which that Hall of Fame term, inner circle, we hear all the time now, and it's Hank Aaron and Babe Ruth and Mickey Mantle and Ted Williams, but not, alas, Carlton Fisk, right? It's... This is someone who belongs in that group with Ellington and Parker and Miles Davis and Coltrane. I don't know how much better you could be a jazz piano than Bud Powell. To me, he is someone who, he doesn't have the technique of an Art Tatum, but he, again, that notion of, he deployed his technique and his artistry, I feel like, more rewardingly, more fruitfully than Tatum did. He got more out of his ability than Tatum. Tatum wowed you. How do you play like that? Whereas Bud Powell moved you And wowing and moving, I'm not saying that there couldn't be overlap and Tatum didn't move us as well, but they're not really the same thing. Tatum is someone I think of as a Paganini on the violin, and Paganini could play things that no one else could play. That's why everyone thought he was in league with the devil. And our Tatum was like that with the Crossroads mythos. But Bud Powell is so soulful. He is so understanding of what other people in his units are doing that he blends perfectly with them while also creating this transcendent art that it seems to stand apart even as it's so a part of something else.
He had more than his share of demons with the drugs, alcohol, battled a number of medical issues, and of course, like a lot of jazz greats, died young as well. Does that impact his lasting notoriety in the world of jazz?
I suppose it does in a way, but it probably would more if, as you mentioned, that wasn't the case for so many of these guys. Bud Powell's personal life, the things he struggled with, it is a horror show, but the horror show is in some ways narratively obviated, I would say, by so many others having their version of the horror show. And even Eric Dolphy, who didn't really go through the horror show this way, he died young too. Not as young as a lot of these guys, like, for instance, Booker Little, who paired wonderfully with Dolphy. He died in his mid-20s. Dolphy at least got into his mid-30s. But he was a haunted man, Bud Powell, just like his friend Charlie Parker. Charlie Parker had all of these stays and mental institutions, and it was characterized at the time as a nervous breakdown, and he was someone who went through a lot of bad times. And these two guys, it's something I want to write a big feature on next year. Powell and Parker played together in Toronto, and they were in this super band for this amazing concert, and maybe the ultimate concert ever given in North America, quite conceivably. And it was the only time this unit came together, and it was sort of the last hurrah on record for Charlie Parker, and it wasn't far off for Bud Powell.
Finally, boy, an incredible performance captured in video with Billie Holiday. Was this a television show, The Sound of Jazz?
That's exactly what it was, and it remained the best jazz program ever aired on TV. And it's 1957. And Lady Day, you heard that name given to her by Lester Young, Prez, that name given to him by her, are going to have this appearance together. There are all these different stars of jazz at the time. And 1957 was actually a great year for Billie Holiday. And I use the word actually because people usually think that she was pretty much done by this point. She's going to die in July of 1959. And Lester Young, her musical symbiotic partner, is going to die just a few months before that, 4 months before that, in the spring, March. So she recorded some sessions in January of 1957 that are among the best things she ever did, and no one knows that. And Lester Young was not well at this time, and he had disappeared, and people didn't know if he was even going to show up for this performance. And if he did show up, he was kind of going to be in the background, and who knows what he was going to do, just comp along. Not a real lot was expected of him. And during this song, sung by Holiday, Fine and Mellow, Prez steps forward to play this solo to remind everyone, at least this last time, that he still could play really as no one else could play. He had a rival in the Count Basie band back in his salad days named Herschel Evans. And in his rival said, hey, you don't have my big tone. I have this awesome tone. And Lester Young looked at him, and he pointed to his stomach, and he said, some of you guys are all belly. And he pointed to his head, and he said, I have it up here. So there's a strange thing that happens, thankfully, during this performance, where the camera, during Young's solo, goes to the face of Billie Holiday, who's not singing. It's almost like the Fisk home run, my guy. and it just happened to have the camera right out in left field. So we watch her real time reaction to him doing and him playing what he's playing, and it will make you, if it doesn't, I just, it will wreck you in a good way.
Yeah, it's an incredible piece. The players are so great that she's with. Her reaction, her singing, it's a rare combination of the obvious physical fragility and then that incredible power and integrity, I think is the word that came to mind in watching her sing in that beautiful, intimate setting.
She did so well in intimate settings like that. Now, there are a lot of people. Kind of a jam session. When you have a jam session with a lot of players, it doesn't often, I really can't think of other examples, hone in on a precise emotional moment. They're diaphanous. They're not built around purpose and focus jam sessions. That's not the nature of a jam session. Now, you might stumble across a lick or a riff or something worth keeping, and you'll use it elsewhere, but you don't really get the kind of takeaway for all-time moments. And she had been swathed in too many string sections for too many years. Her natural setting was the small band environment, but she's the one person, I think, going by, and I've seen this so many times, going by her reaction, where she's not surprised by what he does. They had a friendship. I mean, they weren't romantically involved. They had a friendship. Jazz is based around the dyad. It's based around duos, Gillespie and Parker, Coltrane and Davis, Booker Little and Eric Dolphy. For me, this is the most emotionally satisfying pairing in all of jazz, Billie Holiday and Lester Young.
And I was reading that they produced an album based on this television program and that performance.
Yeah, there was like a soundtrack album that came out. I'd like to write about something for it for December. Early December was when this happened in 1957. So that's on the soundtrack album. And you know what? I'm someone who normally, when there's video, even bootleg video, it's The Who or whatever, I tend not to care. It's weird because I obviously write about film so much and do all of that. With music, I normally just want to hear it. And that's what I would revisit. With this, I want to hear it and see it. And I do wonder why it was filmed this way, because they couldn't have known. Was it a mistake and it was just a happy error that worked out so well? But it visually encapsulates their relationship unlike anything else. And then he's just so on top of it for that solo. He rose to that occasion. And she's nodding her head along as she listens to it. And if you're watching it, as you listen, you're probably doing the same thing, but not with that direct interpersonal thing she had going on with him.
It's so powerful, and it's but the kind of thing you don't see, certainly wouldn't expect to see on network television today.
Well, who would you do it with is the thing. I think if these people were around, and I don't mean that they just kept living, but this is, we come back to this often. If there was organic art that was meant for the person on the other side of the table, and it was someone who was born with more ability than other people, and then they worked their whole life, which is what Lester Young did, to hone that ability, because it's not going to mean anything. You can be Mozart, you can be Beethoven. Without the honing, it's the same thing as not having it, for the most part, except it's tragic because you squandered it. So if there were people like this doing music like this, sometimes I hear, well, there's Taylor Swift, and she sold out Gillette twice, and I go and listen to it, and there's no stylistic comparison. It's coming from a totally different place that I don't think is motivated to reach the person on the other side of the table. And Billie Holiday, because Billie Holiday didn't have the chops of Ella Fitzgerald. The reason when we hear her, we love her so much, and I think people do. I think she's many people's favorite singer once they hear these different jazz vocalists, is because she's singing to reach us. Same kind of idea with Sam Cooke. That's why they were both in that book together. But Lester Young plays that way. And he played to reach her, and she sang to reach him. And then we were brought in on that kind of pyramid. And there we were, and we belonged equally as much, we feel like, when we listen, as they do in their own company.
You can find the video online. It's The Sound of Jazz, Billie Holiday doing Fine and Mellow. Check out Colin's pieces in Jazz Times and The Smart Set as well. Colin, thanks as always, and we'll check in with you again next Tuesday.
Okay, thanks. Sounds good.